That weather forecast. It's not spring yet. It's coming. It's just not here yet. But it is Friday, and it's the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak, and seeing that it's Friday, that means it's the weekly news roundup. We have a lot to talk about today. We're going to start off by talking about some proposed state legislation in New York State. It's a prevailing wage law proposal. It has some members of the business community very concerned. Joining us to talk about this is David Winselberg. David writes for Long Island Business News, LIBN.com. Hi, David. How are you?
Hey, Ron. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. Thanks for doing this. Thanks for being with us. Tell us about this proposal.
Well, you know, this proposal is not new. It's passed the Assembly several years in a row, only to be stalled in the Senate, in the state Senate. And this year, because the Senate is flipped and now has a Democratic majority, observers are saying that the bill has a very good chance to pass even this session. And the bill would basically redefine what public projects are to include private projects that receive any government incentives or publicly funded financial assistance. And they would be forced to pay prevailing wages.
And so when you say redefine, does that mean those that actually get cash as an incentive or possibly just a tax incentive?
Well, it's could be tax incentives like, you know, IDA benefits, Industrial Development Agency benefits. But it also could be tax credits that are given by the state for affordable housing projects and renewable energy projects. So anything where any public money is injected to a private project, that would redefine it as a public project, and it would be required to pay prevailing wages.
Now, I know this is just a proposal, right? What do you think the odds are that it might get passed in Albany?
Well, you know, I don't really know. I can't really predict if it'll get passed as written. You know, I've spoken to a whole bunch of people on this, and one of the co-sponsors of the bill is a state senator, Monica Martinez, from here on Long Island. And she says that they're still meeting with stakeholders on both sides of the issue to try to see how they can maybe make some amendments or make some changes to the bill so that it doesn't impact developers and business so much. So it's very possible, Ron, that the bill, if it does get passed, could be, you know, either watered down or amended so that there's some carve-outs for certain projects or certain size projects or something like that.
Now, David, I was reading your article, and nice reporting. The union leaders are saying that this is going to level the playing field, right? It would simply give contractors some more money and possibly a road to being middle class.
Yeah, well, you know, that's interesting because most of the time when you require prevailing wage, it's really another way of saying hire union contractors because union contractors already pay prevailing wage on their A rate. So it's sort of an interesting thing to say that it will level the playing field. I think what the union leader meant by leveling the playing field is that these days in a free market system, you know, developers can go to contractors and shop around and get the best price or whatever, and that sometimes means a non-union contractor. So union contractors can sometimes lose business because they have to pay a higher rate and they can't bid for a job as low as maybe a non-union contractor can. So I think what the union leader was saying in that respect was, hey, if they have to pay prevailing wage on everything, then we're going to be on a level playing field with the non-union contracts.
I'm going to talk with you for another. We're having some phone difficulties. We apologize about that. But I'm going to talk with you for another minute or two, get another question in, and then we're going to bring in Greg Wenner, who's going to be talking about a different subject. David, is this going to be a tough one for some Democratic legislators? I mean, they don't want to upset the unions, right? But they also don't want to upset the business community.
You know, Ron, that's exactly right. I mean, it's sort of they're walking a tightrope here. I think probably their caucus told them to go ahead and sponsor this or support this legislation. But they've gotten a lot of blowback from the development community on it and the business community at large. IDAs are very incensed about it because they feel that they may have to give even larger and deeper incentives to counteract the increase, you know, if this bill passes, to counteract any increase in labor costs. So, they've been taking it on the chin certainly from the development and the business community. So I guess we have to see how that's going to shake out.
David Winselberg, he writes for Long Island Business News. And if you want to read the excellent article about what we were talking about, libn.com. David, thank you. I appreciate your time. I hope you come back.
Thanks, Ron. Hey, have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too. Let's bring in Greg Winter now. Greg's a reporter for the Southampton Press. If you go to 27east.com, you're going to find Greg's article about South Fork commuter connection. Hi, Greg. How are you?
Hey, Ron. I'm doing great. How you doing?
All right. Greg, for those who may not be familiar with the commuter connection in the South Fork, what is it?
So it's finally, we've got additional trains on the east end of Long Island. It's something that people have been asking for, government officials have been trying to get, and this is a way to bring them so that commuters or people trying to get to work can actually take the train to get there. And what's even better is the towns out here, East Hampton and Southampton, have worked with the state to get additional funding to bring buses in that'll take people actually from the train station to work.
So it's a train service on existing tracks, right? I mean, no new tracks have been put down.
Exactly. There's only actually one track that heads out here. So it's really tricky how they were able to get this to work, but, you know, they were able to get it to work.
So now they have these shuttles. They line them up at the stations, right? And basically it helps commuters get to their jobs. They get to ditch the car.
That's right. They get to ditch the car at them. You know, either early in the morning at 6:16 from Spionk or even later in the day from Hampton Bays. But they can drop their car off and get taken as far out as Montauk.
So the first train is at 6:16?
Right. It's at 6:16 out of Spionk. It's really early. And one of the complaints that I'm getting from some of my readers is that the train will either get them to work too early or to get them there too late.
So. But it overall, the idea sounds great. I mean, you don't drive. You can go online. You could read 27east.com. You could listen to WSHU. But are there enough people who will take advantage of this?
Well, no, I think it's too early to say. We're not getting the traffic really doesn't pick up on the east end until probably April. So right now, it's a slow period, and people don't find the need to have to take the train. But when they're sitting in traffic from Hampton Bays into Southampton Town or Southampton Village, they're going to be thinking of alternatives, and the train's going to be there for them.
Hmm. Who's paying for this? Where'd the money come from?
So the state definitely helped out. I believe the state gave $500,000 to help pay for it, and then the towns are working. Another $500,000 for sure. The rest of it, I'm really not sure. Can't answer it.
Okay. How much is a ticket?
Each ticket is $4.25 each way.
Each so okay.
$8.50 round trip, and that includes that last mile transportation.
So you're saying that once they get off and you get on the bus or the shuttle, you don't have to pay for that either. That's included in the $8.50 round trip.
Correct.
Doesn't sound like a bad deal.
No.
Is this something that you think tourists will be taking advantage of?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I was talking to Supervisor Jay Schneiderman, and he said he had spoken to a guy who he figured in the summertime he could just take the train out to the east end, you know, at different times instead of the couple times that the train actually ran out here to enjoy the beaches. So there's going to be a lot more people that are taking advantage of that.
Well, anybody who's ever been stuck in the traffic, right, will obviously be very happy to have an alternative.
Absolutely. That traffic gets horrendous during the morning commute, and I, for one, will probably be taking the train.
Now, they've been planning this for a while, right? What took so long?
Really not sure what took so long. I know funding took a little bit. I think it was the assemblymen had to get approval from the other, assemblymen in the state, and there was a lot of approvals that needed to take place in order to get this.
All right. Is there anything else? I mean, is this it for a while in terms of additional service on the track? Is this it? Anything else being planned?
For now, that's it. I believe in May 17th, they're going to make a change to the schedule, but what changes they make are yet to be seen. So we'll have to wait and see.
All right. Greg Wenner is a reporter for the Southampton Press. You can read his reporting at 27east.com. Greg, thank you. We appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot, Ron. Take care.
Have a nice weekend. You're listening to The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. It's the weekly news roundup. And coming up, Ken Dixon is going to be joining us. Kenny is a reporter for Hearst, Connecticut newspapers. He has a lot that he'll be telling us about in terms of the state capitol, what's going on there. Also, his take. And Anna Radelet will be joining us on the phone from Washington. She is the Washington correspondent for CTMirror.org. Anna will be talking about the latest survey out of the Coast Guard Academy in terms of sexual harassment. And we'll also be talking about George Jepson, who's the former state attorney general. He's telling a bunch of towns in Connecticut, drop your opioid lawsuits, let the state handle it. It's The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. Ken Dixon is with us in the studio. But before we get to Ken, we're going to be speaking with Anna Radelet, who is the Washington correspondent for ConnecticutMirror.org, CTMirror.org. Hi, Anna. Thank you for coming back with us.
Thank you for having me back.
So, two stories for you and I to talk about today. And they both relate to stories that you have written in the last week for CT Mirror. The first has to do with the Coast Guard Academy in New London. Tell us about that preliminary results of that gender relations survey that you wrote about.
Well, the Coast Guard and the other military academies are required to survey, their cadets or, every 2 years. And the preliminary results, or the results in a preliminary report, show that big jump in the numbers of cadets who report unwanted sexual contact. That could be anything from, tap on the behind to rape. Okay, it's all classified as unwanted sexual contact. That rose from 8% to 12.4%, or that's a 55% jump between 2016, the last time the two-year report was done, to the latest report in 2018.
That's quite a jump.
Yes, but it mirrors what's happening at the Naval Academy in Annapolis and, West Point and the Air Force Academy. They all have similar surveys, and they reported their findings, I think, at the end of January, and it shocked everyone because all of them reported similar 50% jumps in unwanted sexual contacts.
I know in your story you say that the assistant commander of cadets called the results alarming.
Yes, I think a lot of people are alarmed. There have been congressional hearings on this. This is the rate of the increase in reported sexual harassment and sexual contacts, because harassment's up too. I mean, sometimes you can verbally harass without, having contact. You could make a person feel threatened. And that's up sharply at the academies too. So it's higher, it's been increasing in the active military, but it seems to be increasing more at the academies.
More than half the incidents reported involve alcohol?
Yes, I think alcohol is, especially when it comes to unwanted sexual contact, seems to be a player. Although the Coast Guard is very careful, and the other academies too, in trying to make linkages, hard linkages between that.
You know, I'm still trying to understand the numbers. I know it has risen, so that doesn't confuse me. But one aspect of your reporting that I found intriguing was that some say that the rise in the surveys is the greater willingness to report this horrible behavior and actions.
Well, we know in the active military, and we do know also it happens at the academies, that there is sometimes retaliation against somebody who makes an accusation of rape or harassment. And also that's one thing that puts off a lot of people. The second thing is the way you have to report it in the military and in the academies. You have to go up the chain of command. The commander makes the final decision. People are sometimes uncomfortable with that process.
Hmm. So quite possibly years ago, they may not have taken these steps, but times are changing and they are willing to do this now. Possibly.
Possibly. Times are changing and they're willing to do this now. Now there are more women in the active military. There are more women in the academies. And, you know, that might embolden, you know, things a little more when you're not the only one, you know, or one of few. That may help with the reporting. But still, the survey shows that there's a lot more stuff. This survey was anonymous.
Mm.
A lot more stuff going on than actual reports of harassment and sexual.
So you're saying the numbers may still be low or underreported?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, yes. This is all, you know, the cadets, you know, filling out voluntarily, an anonymous survey. This is not formal reports of harassment, wanted sexual contact, which are much lower.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Anna, could you stay with us for just a few moments? I want to bring Ken Dixon in. Ken is with us usually on a weekly basis. He's from Hearst, Connecticut newspapers. How are you, Ken?
I got here.
Get here.
Sliding head first.
Ken, Anna, just in case you don't know, covers politics in the state capital scene in Connecticut. But today, Ken, I'm going to ask you to start outside of Hartford. You know the Bridgeport area very well. You've covered it for decades now. And obviously Bridgeport, which is Connecticut's largest city, is struggling with what's going on with its police department. Fill us in.
Oh, there was an internal investigation. It was finally released almost a year and a half after an incident that involved as many as 45 cops. It started with a noise complaint. It was a party in downtown, and it escalated. And this internal affairs report says 17 cops are allegedly implicated in a variety of misbehavior, and it's framed by two recent suicides of officers who were supervisors at that scene. And the report's released at a time where there's a certain amount of backlash in the city regarding police malfeasance, alleged police malfeasance. There's still a festering wound from a police shooting of a 15-year-old from pushing 2 years ago. And it's tense.
And this incident took place how long ago?
The party was October of 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And the report was just released to us coincidentally by the police this week from an FOI request a couple months ago.
Why did the report take so long?
Well, I think the report was dated in November. So why did police reports take so long? You know, I could editorialize and say the police are trying to sit on information. I mean, that's what people in the neighborhood are saying. Something like this is super complicated. I mean, 17 officers involved. It's our story in the paper today is talking about how the police commission could take months parsing through all these disciplinary cases. Yeah.
And two officers have committed suicide.
Yeah. Two officers involved in that case. It's remarkably sad. Police, inner city police. You've got racial aspects. You've got guys. I've listened to police scanners for years. Most of the calls are like, you know, domestic problems, and you're an underpaid social worker thrust into somebody's house with people in extremists. It's a super tough job. You've got racial tensions, economic, social problems. It's like police have a lot of pressure on them.
Anyone who has police officers as part of their family or friends can understand how difficult that job is.
Yeah, and that Saturday night, I mean, the guys were coming in. They were being called in to help officers. I mean, off-duty guys were showing up, but that must have been a crazy scene. And, you know, it's just a few blocks from the heart of downtown, you know.
And the other aspect to this is for those who know Bridgeport and have been waiting for Bridgeport to have its turnaround, which it's been trying to do for quite a number of years now, decades as a matter of fact, I know city officials want the city to turn around desperately, and now this is leading the news, obviously.
Yeah, well, that's too bad. I mean, it goes back a couple of administrations where they were putting, even under Bill Finch, they were putting the kibosh on our being able to look at police incident reports, and Ganim's kind of it's the same thing. He's trying to he's running for re-election too, by the way, so he wants to put on a happy face.
It's a story that I know will continue to evolve and unfold over the next number of weeks, and we're glad that Ken could be here with us to talk about that. I want to bring Anna back in, Anna Radelet, the Washington correspondent for ctmirror.org, because we wanted to touch on one other story that Anna has written about in the last week. And again, you could find all her articles at ctmirror.org. Anna, this relates to George Jepson, who's the former state attorney general. And what he's been saying, he wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal about the opioid lawsuits. Tell us a little bit more.
Yes, as attorney general, Jepson was the lead attorney general, and there were quite a few of them, who started to investigate the role that opioid manufacturers and distributors had in the nation's addiction crisis. And he, you know, pushed this. They haven't filed a lawsuit, but they've been working on this issue. And they've been working on this issue with the intent of getting a settlement. A large settlement, multi-billion dollar settlement, which the states would then, you know, share and use for various purposes, hopefully primarily to combat addiction and prevent addiction and treat addicts. But Jepson believes that, you know, a flurry of lawsuits by counties, by cities, by towns, and there's about 2,000 of them across the nation, and I've lost count, but I know it's much more than a dozen, maybe much more than two dozen Connecticut towns have also filed their separate lawsuits. Jepson wants them to drop it because it muddies the water. It makes it harder for the states to get a settlement from the parties they haven't sued yet, but they're investigating at this point. And so he'd like them to step out of the picture, and he promises that they would, you know, they would benefit too because they would get a cut of whatever settlement is awarded the states.
But he's not actively involved in the lawsuits anymore, right? Now he's in private practice.
Right, and I think that he is not, and he cannot ethically be involved in the lawsuit as a member of a private law firm. But I think he's invested a lot of time in this, and he's in a position, because he's not in public office, to be able to make this statement for the AGs, who may not be able to say, hey, Hartford, you know, stop this, or New Haven, or Bridgeport.
So politically, he's somewhat safe.
He is somewhat safe. He doesn't, you know, he's not going to get a backlash from a lot of angry mayors or first selectmen. So he can say it. I think he's being a mouthpiece for the other AGs.
Have you heard anything from any of the town officials about this?
No, I tried to reach out to several, but they were completely non-responsive. I know that in the state assembly, and I haven't watched this very closely because I'm not in Hartford, but I think there's enough effort to draft some legislation that would help the states and the cities and towns with their lawsuits. You know, a bunch of them were rejected in January in state court because the judge said they had no standing. So I know that there's a move afoot to try to get some legislation that would fix that legal issue that gave them no standing. Hmm. So they don't look like they're quitting. They look like they're trying to find ways to pursue their lawsuit.
Ken Dixon is going to be with us in the next segment, so maybe Ken can comment on that, give us a little bit of an update from the Hartford perspective. And to complicate matters, there is reporting now that Stanford-based Purdue Pharma, they're the ones that makes OxyContin, they're considering filing for bankruptcy, aren't they? That is according to some reports.
Yes. Yes, it's been reported that they're considering filing for bankruptcy to limit their liability in all these lawsuits. Now, once again, a bankruptcy judge will have to make that decision. They're not in bad financial shape. So, you know, just because they're considering and might try to file for bankruptcy or might file for bankruptcy, they may not get what they hope for.
I wonder if anyone has done a story about the nonprofits in this area and the others who have received money in the past from the Sackler family. The Sackler family owns Purdue Pharma, and they've been well known for a number of years for giving to charities and nonprofits in this region. And I wonder how that is shaking out now.
I've seen some reports, but, you know, sometimes I walk by the Sackler Gallery here in Washington. It's a huge art gallery. The Sackler family, and it was not, you know, it was the foundation founded by a previous Sackler, not the Sacklers of today. But, you know, the Sacklers have been philanthropic for generations, at least three generations, as far as I know.
Hmm.
So a lot of, you know, the foundation and a lot of the Sackler giving predates the Sacklers, who are involved and accused of wrongdoing as far as their opioid manufacturing. And some of it comes from a foundation that is distanced from the family. So, as I said, you know, we've got one of the most beautiful art museums here in Washington established by the foundation. I believe it was the foundation. I hope I'm not misspeaking. That's a complicated issue.
It's another aspect to an incredibly complicated story. Anna, before you go, let me just ask you about what is taking place with Plum Island.
Oh, well, you know, it's for sale. And the federal government wants to sell it to help defray some of the expense of moving its animal biological lab to Manhattan, Kansas, where they're going to build a bigger, newer, very much more secure lab to conduct biological experiment. Nobody knows what goes on there.
No, but Plum Island has always had this almost mythical presence. I mean, people have said, don't go there. All these crazy things happen there. And there's always been something about it, this aura.
Right, because it's off limits. It was, you know, the federal government was doing some, you know, secretive and dangerous testing of biological agents in that lab. Animal diseases they were testing, and people assumed that maybe they were testing other things too that have to do with biological stuff. I'm sorry, I'm not a chemist or a biologist, so my knowledge of this type of stuff is very limited.
You and me both.
But you know, because it was, you know, they're doing dangerous stuff, and because it's high, I mean, the security on that lab is very high. And the one they're going to build to replace it is even going to be higher. That was one of the reasons, and it's under the Department of Homeland Security, not under the Department of, you know, any other health department or ag department, which has to do with animal disease. But it's under Homeland Security now, so you can see that, you know, it is a Homeland Security issue. As I understand it, one of the problems with Plum Island is that it wasn't secure enough for the government's needs. So, you know, stuff goes on there. What can I say?
So in effect, Connecticut and New York simply don't want the sale to go through?
They don't want, once that lab is moved, then the federal government has no use for the island. And they don't, but the beauty of it being off limits to the public is that, you know, only a tiny bit of the island is used for the lab. The rest was allowed to be in its natural state. And that has, you know, resulted in some very unique, you know, environmentalists and preservationists say, very unique flora, very unique fauna, animals and plants. And here, I'm not a botanist or an expert, as I said, a biologist, so I can't really speak very intelligently on that. But there, you know, they cited a number of species that would be imperiled. If there, you know, this thing was just opened up for development.
We'll see what happens there. It's going to be interesting. Anna, we always appreciate your time. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Anna Radelet, the Washington correspondent for ctmirror.org. Ken Dixon is still with us for the remainder of the program. Ken is the writer, columnist for Hearst, Connecticut newspapers, covering politics, the state capital scene. We talked a little bit about Bridgeport before. What was the hot story of the past week in Hartford?
The five-letter word.
Uh-oh.
Tolls.
Tolls. I know some people were thinking, what? What five letters? Tolls still, huh?
Yeah. Okay. But you got me thinking about how the Sackler family could be like living in the Temple of Dendur at the Metropolitan Museum. So thanks, Ron.
We'll go back to that one later.
To take their sleeping bags out and, you know.
That's what the kids actually do at the Museum of Natural History, which you could go in the room with the big whale, and then the kids put the bags out, and they spend the night there. Yeah, you'll figure it out.
That's a hard floor. I don't have kids, so I don't have to worry about that.
So where's the toll situation now in Connecticut?
Transportation was voting on it this afternoon. Transportation Committee, yeah.
As to whether or not it should go to the next step?
Yeah, well, it would go to the floor. They've got till June 6th to ping pong the bill back, among the finance
D-day.
Committee to figure out how much money would be made. And I still think there's a chance that these people might not approve it this year.
Really? I was just going to say, is it a done deal?
Well, the governor wants it. Right out of the box, but he's still, you know, finding like where stairwells are in the Capitol and stuff. So.
Still figuring things out up in Hartford. I see some of the latest news reports are about whether or not there should be a public-private partnership in terms of establishing the tolls when they do go up.
Well, that could accelerate stuff as it is. It's like would be the end in Governor Lamont's first term before the gantries. There's a word. I love that word, gantry.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it sound like you're taking off somewhere, you know, for the moon.
Run the gantry.
Yeah.
So if it does get approved, the tolls probably won't be put in place till 2023 or so?
Yeah, something like that.
And they are still going with the idea of how many were there? 53?
Yeah, and at a cost of like about $215 million.
To build them?
Yeah.
Okay, and then how much are they anticipating in terms of revenue bringing in every year?
Well, it depends on how many times you take the I-95 to work, Ron, you know.
I try to avoid 95 like most people do, but I have to.
$800 million to a billion. They're saying, you know, 40% of that would be picked up by out-of-staters. That's kind of a good way to sell this, you know, thing about, you know, the bill would be footed by out-of-staters.
So here's my big question for you. Some people I know are saying, okay, look, I think tolls are going in. I'm okay with that. Just promise me that this money will actually go to fix the roads, to fix the bridges, and to fix the trains. What are the odds that that will happen?
Well, better now that, you know, a vast majority of people understood the question on the November ballot, you know, the so-called
transportation
lockbox. But where there's a will, there's a way in the legislature.
So nothing is ever completely 100% guaranteed, even though that money should go to transportation. Maybe it'll go someplace else.
Well, if it goes there, it would stay there. But, you know, it's a circuitous path from your monthly bill for your easy pass to the lockbox.
And just before we move on to other topics, just to clarify, would this be a set price that you would pay to go through the tolls, or would it be congestion pricing where the price would be variable?
Yeah, it has to be congestion pricing under the rules that this would be approved.
So the Transportation Committee has it today. Next step, it would go to the floor, and then after
the floor of one of the chambers, and, you know, if I saw the bill, I could tell you if it's the House or Senate.
Okay. And then by June or so, you figure we'll have a decision.
You know, last year they said, the Speaker of the House said so many times that we're going to vote on tolls today, and it never happened, which is why I'm looking at the whole thing with a jaundiced eye still. There's still a good chance that nothing can happen this session. No weed. Mm-hmm. That would be recreational marijuana for the folks back home. Family medical leave, who knows, $15 minimum wage, tolls. I mean, those are the big issues. And you know, until a bill hits the floor, you know, it's up in the air.
So legalizing marijuana, you think? Because again, when we first started this program back in November, you and I were talking off the air. I thought it was pretty much a done deal because the governor-elect at that time was behind it, and it seemed that it had a lot of support in Hartford, especially amongst the progressives, who are pretty strong right now in terms of their support of Lamont and this bill.
Well, the progressives, this is a big test for like the actual numbers of so-called progressives. You know, you gotta raise your hand, you gotta get something done, and you know, there's really not even a bill for recreational cannabis.
And Governor Lamont is still in favor of it. I you know, he was here on the program the week before, and when we said to him, are you still in support? And he said, look, the cat's out of the bag. People are going up to Massachusetts now to buy it. New York is probably going to do it. Yeah, I'm still in support of it. But he said, open to the idea of opting out. Towns or communities, town cities would be able to say, you know what, it's legal in the state. We just don't want it dispensed here.
Well, he offered it, you know, up to the legislature, and it's in their job, you know, until June 5th to come up with bills and a budget. And you know, it's hard work. He's offered stuff that they've turned down in the past about expanding the base for the sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
There was a reason why they've they've exempted lawyers from service taxes and financial advisors and accountants and stuff. And you know, he can offer whatever he wants, but it's up to 151 members in the House and 36 in the Senate.
Can we talk for a minute about recycling? The other month we did a program here, and it was one of our most popular programs. We talked about it out on the island and across Connecticut, what it means to towns and cities and how they make money. And now we're hearing all these reports saying, you know what, the Chinese market has dried up. They don't want our stuff anymore. And where towns, some towns and cities used to make money from recycling, now it's costing them money. They're paying people to take our goods that we normally would recycle. Where does that stand?
I've got a story for Sunday that I just put online, actually. There are a bunch of bills. Households need to change their behavior. They're throwing improper things into the big blue recycle bin, like propane tanks and rubber hoses that don't belong there. The glass, there's virtually no market for glass. All the glass that's collected is being used for dressing the tops of landfills in other states. So the Environment Committee's got a big hearing on Monday on expanding the bottle bill, doubling the nickel to 10 cents. We have the lowest redemption rate for deposit bottles and cans in the country at around 50%. And they figure they're going to double it. They're going to expand it to wine bottles and sports drinks, you know, stuff they should have done a while ago. And there are pilot programs on kitchen food waste, collecting that at the sidewalk up in around Danbury in Litchfield County. They've also done a glass pilot project also, and people are going to have to change their behavior.
I think many people just take a lot of the stuff that they have in the kitchen, pizza boxes with grease on them and so on, and they figure, okay, it's cardboard, throw it in the recycle bin.
Actually, cardboard pizza boxes are okay with the grease.
Even with the grease, really?
Even with the grease. I found that out. I was talking to somebody who's in charge of the Housatonic Resource Recovery Authority up around Danbury, and she was telling me about the propane tanks. But pizza boxes are okay.
That's actually kind of scary to hear that someone would do something like that.
Yeah, the more we know, the more scared we are, Ron. There's another bill that would require paper producers to have greater responsibility for recycling their stuff.
Mm. And just out of curiosity, did anyone say anything about, in terms of, you said we have one of the lowest rates in the country for the bottles? Did they?
Probably the lowest.
The lowest. That's pretty amazing to hear. You could read Ken's story this weekend. What's the solution? Just charge people more to force them to go and recycle this?
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why Governor Lamont has wanted a new deposit on nips, you know, that we drink and throw out the car window on the roadside, right, Ron?
No, we don't. Those days are long gone. How much does he want to charge?
10 cents. Okay. I think he wants a nickel on the nip, but the environmentalists think 10 cents or more is better. I mean, I know people who would, you know, just as soon put it in the blue bin than get the nickel back, and it's you know, it's a waste on several levels.
We have about 2 minutes left. I believe there's also some hearings coming up this next week on gun legislation, gun safety.
Yeah, Monday that'll bring out the usual suspects, so to speak. The new co-chair of Judiciary is a Bridgeport lawmaker, Steve Staffstrom, who I know wants to get this bill. It's crazy as it sounds. It's like if you're an open carry person, you do not have to show your permit to a police officer who asks you in public whether you have a permit or not. And that's, yeah. It's based on a Bridgeport incident at a sandwich shop, and I personally don't like to see open carry. I might have walked out of the restaurant even just seeing it, but that's one of those laws that exists and that makes covering the Capitol interesting, Ron.
I didn't even know about this law, so that in you're saying in Connecticut you can actually have
carry, and you don't have to show your permit if you were asked by a cop to show your permit.
So you could walk around here with the gun as long as you have a valid permit.
Open carry or even concealed carry, because that's what the permit's for, and you don't have to show, you know, the cop notices a bulge or something.
Mm-hmm. And so the intent of this legislation is to change that.
Yeah, to make people accountable, make gun owners more responsible.
We have 1 minute left, and I just want to bring up something that we touched on last week. Economists went to Albany, and they were talking to the leaders in Albany, and they said, look, there's a recession coming. Not this year, but next year. And they said the signs are pointing to a slowdown. Are you hearing anything up in Hartford where some of the legislators or the governor and his people are saying, you know what, we need to take this into account in terms of our budgeting? And they're working very hard to try and balance what there is now.
Well, yeah, and even more so today, my colleague Dan Haar's reporting on a very dismal jobs report for the end of 2018. Mm-hmm. That's scary.
Okay, so they're obviously aware of this because obviously the governor and all his people were hearing all these proposals, and I just haven't seen anything yet, but I'm assuming that'll be coming this weekend in Hearst, Connecticut
newspapers.
Yeah,
and also there are the early tax filing information is not very rosy either.
Ken, it's always a pleasure talking with you. Always rosy and rosy outlook. It's always good to see you. Ken is just staring at okay. me right now.
I'm just trying to figure out what you're saying, Ron.
Ken Dixon. He covers the state capitol and politics and a number of other events going on in Connecticut. Ken, thank you, as always.
Thanks, Ron.
I hope you have a wonderful weekend. That is going to do it for our show today. Joelle Schrock is behind the board. She's our engineer. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. Carrie Frank is our digital editor. Ann Lopez is the producer. And Terry Sheridan, our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. I hope all of you have a wonderful weekend. Thanks to all of you for being part of The Full Story.